I just want to say a quick thanks to everyone who has left a podcast review so far. It's been fantastic to see what you guys are making of the podcast and really enjoy reading them. Rest assured, I do read every single one. So thanks again. And if you haven't left a review yet, it would do us a massive favor if you would, as that would help us grow this community and reach more grassroots coaches who will benefit from these conversations. So thanks again, and we really appreciate it. Welcome to the Athletic Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Robin Eager. Robin is currently the Men's Pathways Athletic Performance Manager at England Rugby, having worked with the under-20s team for 6 seasons. He's also previously held roles in the academies at both Gloucester Rugby and Leicester Tigers. Robin has a wealth of experience working with the developing rugby player. So welcome to the podcast, Robin. Thanks for coming on.
No problem, mate. Thanks for having me on. Really excited to
have a good chat.
Yeah, you've had some great guests on. I follow the podcast, so really looking forward to, well, thanks for having me on.
Brilliant. So for those who haven't come across you before, give us a bit of the story in terms of how you got involved in sport as an athlete and how that's led you to working at England Rugby.
The journey. I'm glad that you used the word athlete. It's not necessarily how I would describe myself. Not necessarily come from like a high performance background in terms of playing. So generally just absolutely love sport growing up. Sampled heaps of sports. Rugby is my passion probably from about the age of 15. That sort of became my main sport. And then just through being around sport, training, playing, and studying, like PE throughout school and A-levels, just started to try and take as many opportunities as I could, just wherever coaching opportunities came up throughout A-levels. So that would be teaching extracurricular PE lessons in primary schools to helping out sports coaches at the school. So just tried to, well, essentially I just fell in love with coaching. Had no idea at that time that S&C would necessarily be my passion. But I think, you know, I think there's obviously a lot of similarities, and you learn a lot in terms of trying to manage groups of kids that some don't necessarily want to be there because it's PE, some absolutely love it, and like heaps of different ages and abilities. So I think, you learn a lot there. And then from there, went to Loughborough University, studied sports science. And again, like that's obviously a university with a rich history, and your opportunities there are great. So never, like I was playing rugby at sort of a local level for my local club, which I'm still pretty heavily affiliated to now. I wasn't necessarily playing any performance rugby, just loved the sport, played for fun with friends, sort of ran intramural side as well. So always had a bit of a passion for organising, coaching, that kind of it as well, which was great. So 3 years at Loughborough, which is unbelievable, got exposed to, you know, some great learning there and great practitioners, researchers, etc., which was good. And then fortunately managed to get an opportunity as an intern at Leicester. Initially didn't get the opportunity, which I was devastated about because I'm a Leicester Tigers fan, love rugby, and I thought, you know, this is just the dream position. And then the story goes that of the two people that were appointed, one of them only lasted a day and quit to become a hairdresser. And they thought, you know what, who's local? And I happened to be just down the road and probably available much easier than a lot of the other guys that they probably wanted to hire. Anyway, got that job and just had got that internship, which was great because it was just 20 minutes up the road from family home. And so, you know, all the challenges that come with being an intern, etc. I was very fortunate that I could, you know, just put my all into being there and immersing myself in that environment. I was at Leicester for 4 years in the end, so managed to cling on and stick around. And they were four incredible, incredible years, and learnt loads, and made some really friends for life and mentors for life. Went through some pretty challenging times as well, as you do as a young practitioner, where you're trying to figure things out and you think you've cracked it, you think you know it all, and You make a lot of mistakes as well, but get exposed to so many great practitioners. And then in my final year at Leicester, I started helping out with the England under-20s as sort of assistant to a guy called Neil Taylor. So going in mainly to help out just in terms of more sports science-based stuff. So help him out with the GPS side of things, more training, readiness, etc. And then just being an assistant coach. And that was just born out of the relationship developed over that time at Leicester. I know the practitioners had a really good relationship with him and the union. So that was sort of my route into the RFU. And I've sort of been there ever since. Initially as a contractor, so I left Leicester at the end of my fourth season, but maintained, working with the 20s on a contract basis. But that gave me a bit more time to go and see some other environments. So I spent time, a lot of time with England Sevens and like Dan Howes and Tom Farrow there, who like just opened my eyes really in terms of, you know, I'd been used to seeing one way and one methodology for 4 years, and then just having the opportunity to go and explore new things, I think was the most valuable experience in my early career, to be honest. One thing I'd encourage any young coach to do is just go and explore different environments from day one. I think I was backfilling that experience because I just immersed myself solely in what I was doing, which is important, but I think breadth of experience is important. But Dan and Tom Farrow are world-class operators, so learned loads from them and still do. Managed to, because I had a lot of time on my hands, the under-20 season didn't kick off till sort of Six Nations time, really. It was 2015 and it was World Cup year, so I went in to help out with the senior squad just on an intern basis again. So again, immersed in that environment, which was an unbelievable opportunity. Obviously didn't go quite so well for England in the end, but just like I wrote notes every night, tried to get involved in everything. I still look back on my notes and try and reflect on that experience because there were so many lessons and learned. You know, I was around so many great practitioners, coaches, players. So I learned heaps there. Following that season, went to Gloucester. And it was during my season at Gloucester as academy conditioner that I was offered the role with the RFU full-time, so make my contract position a full-time position. So despite buying a house in Gloucester and, you know, being set to be there for 5-6 years, which I think is important from a youth development perspective, that you're there for the long term, and I was fully committed to doing that. I just couldn't turn the opportunity down to work at the union full-time, so I've sort of been there full-time since 2017, so 6 years involved. Yeah, been at a couple of clubs, and yeah, managed to have a bit of time to see some different environments as well. So, all, yeah, present day. And currently I am one of the few coaches in rugby, S&C coaches, not actually able to coach because when you're in an international environment, we've obviously not got a group of players. So guys are obviously back at their clubs going through the COVID returns. I'm very jealous of those guys, but speaking to those guys a lot regularly, and it's obviously very challenging, but yeah, waiting to get back into it, really. And that's where we are.
So you've kind of obviously already mentioned some good experiences and, you know, the 2015 World Cup and obviously being at Leicester. What are some of the other kind of highs and lows during the career so far, things that stand out to you?
One of the big realities at Leicester was the amount of change that we went through in the fourth or the final season I was there. I mean, at the time, Leicester were, you know, they were on that run where they were in Premiership finals year after year. And the academy was pretty sophisticated in terms of its setup and its staffing. And whenever those guys took to the field against teams, they generally did pretty well. And it just seemed like, you know, everything was hunky-dory. This is what professional sport's like. It's fairly straightforward and easy. And then in that final year, I think one of the biggest lows and just learning moments for me was that it's a pretty harsh world, because I think that season 8 to 10 members of staff left or were sacked or made redundant or what for whatever reason, and there were heaps of change. So whilst that was an unbelievable experience over the 4 years, like that was pretty humbling. And definitely made me think about the reality and the roller coaster of the environment and the industry that we're in. So definitely encouraged me to, you know, to start branching a bit further afield and broadening my skill set a little bit. But that would definitely be one. An absolute high on the back of the 2015 World Cup sort of experience. I got the opportunity in 2016 to work as the sports scientist on an interim basis for the 2016 Six Nations, which was Eddie Jones's first Six Nations, which we, the team managed to get a Grand Slam. So, you know, seeing two environments, one with Stuart with the World Cup, Stuart Lancaster, and then Eddie, that was just unbelievable just to be able to compare and contrast those two environments. And although, like, majority of my experience is in youth sport and, you know, youth athletes, that's my passion. Just being able to see what it was like at the sharp end of the game, I think, is really important just for context and just an idea of what I'm trying to prepare players for. So that would be a real high. If I can, yeah, hopefully I think I contributed the smallest fraction just to that. But yeah, like that was just an unbelievable experience. I think every time you see a young lad achieve, that's a real high. So whether you're at a club and you see them make their first team debut, or you see, you know, a pathway prospect play for England for the first time, I think that is always a high, because that's ultimately what you're in it for. You know, we're here, we're employed to try and support people and players achieve their dream at the end of the day. And you know that the hours that they've spent grafting, the time they've spent on a wet, like a windy and rainy evening on a Monday night, where they've travelled 2 hours after a full day of school, and parents have had to drop everything to make sure that their kid can go to train. You see those things, so you can understand what it means to them and the family when they do that. So that every time that happens, that's a real high. Similarly, like real lows when things don't work out for players, long term injuries where people have to retire. We've all had that. So I think really on an individual basis, you ride the wave a little bit with the guys you coach. And then, can you hear that?
Yeah, it's all right. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's my doorbell. I think as well, lows as well, just from an organisational perspective. Like, I think everyone will be aware of the news with the RFU this week. Like, that's going to be an extremely challenging time, not just for us, but for sport in general. But we went through a similar period two and a half years ago, where there's been a lot of change. With change, there's always that period of resistance, and you generally always come out of it in a good place, and you can move forward. But that's always challenging. So I learned a lot from those experiences as well. But in general, I definitely would look back currently on my career with more positives than negatives, I would say. Yeah.
So you've probably already touched on that a little bit, and, you know, if you kind of refer back to that, it's totally cool. But what would you say is your underlying driver? Like, you've obviously mentioned initially just your love of the game, and then kind of, you know, just in that last question around seeing individual players achieve their dreams. So if you had to sum it up, what would be the why for doing what you do?
I just simply love coaching and helping people. I think that's the inner why. And I really believe in potential. I think that excites me. So I think, you know, the role that I currently operate in, the space I currently operate in, is perfect in that respect. However, I think I could still get the same satisfaction from being in a different environment. So it doesn't have to be in England under 18s or under 20s, you know, elite potential rugby players. It could be, you know, if I was a personal trainer, and I was working with people that were committed to getting better, and I could support them with that, I still think I would be, that would motivate me. And at the same time, like, I love just as much coaching under 14s, 15s, 16s on the grass as I would do, you know, operating in a Six Nations environment or an under 20s World Championship or in a club. So, look, very fortunate to have had the experiences I've had. But I'd like to think that, you know, fundamentally it's about supporting people and helping people get better and achieve potential would be my main driver, my real why, I would say.
So you've obviously kind of already touched on a few experiences that have influenced your coaching practice, but are there any individual people that stand out as being really influential for you in terms of shaping your thought process?
Yeah, well, I think the way I operate is begged, borrowed and stolen from a number of people, as is always the way. I think, well, first and foremost, the role I'm in is like, I'm extremely fortunate because the nature of the role is that I get to go into 14 different environments and see what's going on. So naturally that is learning for me every time I walk through the door, because they're at the coalface. There's some excellent practitioners in the Premiership. So there's probably too many to name there, but there's some really great work going on both at the senior end of the game and developing young athletes. So learning from those coaches all the time. Which I'm extremely fortunate. I think if we go early on in my career from an S&C perspective, the two biggest influencers would be so Kev Mannion, who I know you've had on the podcast, but he sort of afforded me an opportunity at Leicester initially. I spent 4 years shadowing, working with him. Just created like a real, like he's a great friend of mine and a really good mentor. And similarly, a guy called Neil Taylor, who was the S&C coach working with the under-20s at England. Both of those two, I think I learned a lot from them, more than just like a technical S&C perspective, but you know, relationships, soft skills, the value of effort, understanding environments, how to influence players and people. So many lessons that I think have grounded me and really, really important from an early age. So those two are still great friends and great mentors of mine. I speak to them regular. There was obviously a great S&C team at Leicester, which I learned a lot off. But upon leaving there, I'd say the biggest influences. So Dan Howells at Sevens really did open my eyes, and I learned heaps from him. Again, Tom Farrow is there now, but he was his assistant. So the program that those guys put in place really is, you know, top draw. Dan Tobin at Gloucester would be the other one who I was fortunate to be there for a year with him. But he had like huge experience at Leinster. And just, you know, he's a great character. So like just his rapport with players is great. But his methodology, his programming, his constant strive to want to, you know, keep learning and adapt his program is really, you know, really was good. And like his program just made sense. Like every facet of the program had rationale, which, you know, was really important, just made sense. And then currently I work with Tim Hall, again, works with me in the pathway. He's been at Quinn's for 8-9 years before, but he's a world-class operator when it comes to youth development. So very fortunate I get to work with him. And then I guess that's like an S&C perspective. So quite a lot of influences. I'm not naming them all either. But from a non-S&C perspective, like my boss at Leicester initially, Neil McCarthy, was huge for me. He's quite a critical thinker. Those that will know Neil will probably have a giggle at that. But he was invaluable making sure I didn't just stay in this like S&C sports science bubble. You know, how is what I'm doing impacting the team as a whole? How am I challenging other disciplines? How am I accepting challenge from other disciplines? A lot of my passion and knowledge around coaching, pedagogy and psychology and talent development has been born out of discussions with Neil and the way he operates and works. So he would be a great one. And fortunate enough, my boss at the RFU, Scott Draw as well, was the person that really gave me the opportunity at the RFU initially. And he's just a world-class operator in terms of high-performance sports. So, again, just being around people like that has been really, really rich and valuable. And clearly, like in my role, I've been exposed to so many world-class coaches. So Stuart Lancaster, Eddie Jones. And just being able to see them up close and personal and see how they operate has been great, alongside lot of world-class youth development coaches as well. So very, very fortunate in terms of the exposure I've had, really. So
it's obviously kind of, I guess, upgrading and changing all the time. But if you were to kind of describe, I guess, what you're currently using as a model or philosophy for your coaching practice, how would you kind of sum it up?
So I think if I separate two elements, if we go one, firstly, like more from an S&C perspective, and then more from like a coaching and development perspective. So from an S&C perspective, probably the two or three things that we would talk about, and I guess this is developed with Tim as well, so this is the model we're sort of currently operating. So first and foremost with youth athletes, like, you use the simplest method to move things forward. So how do you get the biggest output from the smallest input? We're potentially teeing kids up for, you know, a career in professional sport. That means they've potentially got 15, 20 years of athletic development ahead of them. So we don't have to use advanced methods from day dot. Like, you can move people forward in really progressive and systematic ways, and respect the heaps of stresses that these young athletes are going through anyway. So just applying a load of stress, whilst you might get good short-term gains and adaptations towards maybe some senior standards or whatever it is you're looking for, like, you might be doing them a disservice further down the line. So like, using the simplest method to move things forward, I think, is really important. And players have to earn the right to progress. So it's not an age and stage based model, it's competency based. We're trying to develop athleticism in its general sense first before we're developing specific rugby players. And with that comes heaps of, you know, we talk about movement competency. I don't think people have necessarily grasped it. A lot of people just focus on the gym based stuff, but everything we do has always got to be centered around how well it's being done. Only through doing things with technical execution do you actually train the skill, do you make people more efficient, and you're not running before you can walk in with any of that stuff. So we're not jumping, again, it links back to the last point, you're not linking to more advanced methods before you've done the foundation work. So that would be the second principle. And now, I guess, the headline strap line that we would use, again, Nick stolen from Tim, but it is quite nice, is, you know, first and foremost, you're focusing on how well, and then that permeates throughout their whole career, but how well is your key priority initially. Then we talk about how much, and then we talk about how fast. And of course, we're operating a model where it's concurrent and lots of physical qualities are being developed at once. But that they're sort of how we prioritise as kids progress through. And then that's, like, isolated from a physical perspective, that is in the context of, first and foremost, we're developing sportsmen. So they've got to be better at their sport. So it's not about me and my isolated bubble. First and foremost, how am I making them better at their sport? And that is the key. So if I'm asking the question, is what I'm doing making them better? If not, then why am I doing it? And they're the questions that you've got to ask. Am I just doing it for myself because I've seen it on Twitter, or I've read about it, or am I doing it because it's going to add value to them as players? So in my context, rugby players. From a like more of a coaching perspective, person first, before player. Know them, understand their why, what makes them tick, get to know their family background and their history, their experiences, because that will ultimately inform, you know, your understanding of their character and how you can then optimize their development journey for them. So what kind of challenges or experiences do we need to give player X because of the journey they've come from? But also getting to know the person and building a genuine relationship builds trust, builds empathy, builds buy-in. So I think that is, they're not just a player, they're not just a statistic, they're a person. I think coaching-wise, I'm quite a reserved character anyway, naturally. So, like, I like the phrase, you've got two eyes, two ears, and one mouth. So use them with that ratio. obviously there's time and a place to put your foot down and bark, but that's not going to necessarily have impact if you're always doing it, and also if you're trying to understand what's going on, and also at the same time you're trying to offer young guys opportunity to explore and try things out and fail. Like, you can't be telling them all the time, so they're trying to find that balance. And then, as with everyone, I think everyone, like players, people have got to have clarity. They've got to understand, they must know why. If we can't explain our why to players, why we're using certain methods, why we think this is important to them, players can't explain to me back what their goals are and what they're working on, then how do you expect them to adopt the right behaviours, them to understand the programme, then to therefore be really motivated, them to do the right thing when they're away from us, because they spend the majority of their time away from us. So I think they'll be the key things there as well.
It's some fantastic stuff in there. It seems that I think as an industry, certainly we're from a youth perspective, we're really starting to lean away from just let's get kids super strong. And actually there is a real focus on that, how well, how much, how fast kind of philosophy. Obviously, you know, Des Ryan at Arsenal is very similar kind of philosophy. Yeah. At Scottish Rugby, we're revamping our physical blueprint pretty much with that in mind as well. And I think, you know, there's very much been a let's just get players massive and strong. And now we're starting to realise, well, actually, how much of that's translating when on the pitch. Yeah. You know, it might be nice to look at from an S&C metrics perspective, but they can't do these other skill sets because they're so unathletic. Whereas, like you said, athleticism first.
Well, athleticism's the key, right? And I think we've got to separate like capacities from like competencies and capabilities. So your capacities are the stuff that we can typically measure quite easily. And of course that is important. However, the further down the pathway you go, I think you've got to be focusing more on capabilities, and that's got to be a thread that permeates throughout. And I just think like you're dead right. And in rugby, I think it was born out of the change that happened in France with heaps of cash going in. Then all of a sudden they've got star-studded, you know, squads. Therefore, they can just go really big, really heavy, not necessarily fit or athletic, and just rotate. Well, they're getting world-class players that are probably naturally gifted anyway and naturally athletic. But then also, like, from a general fitness perspective, you don't necessarily have to worry about it. So then all of a sudden we're thinking, right, if English clubs or British clubs are going to compete in Europe, bloody hell, like, if we can't contest the gain line, then we're screwed. So it became this, right, we need to get them big. But, you know, people develop at their own rates. Like, we can't just put one model onto people. And I think strength, other than for potentially front rowers, where it is their function, like their key function on the pitch to be strong, it serves as a supportive process to the other elements. So if guys can't move well, they're not efficient, then they're at increased risk. They're probably like people always think like developing fitness is about throwing conditioning sessions at them. Well, my first port of call will be to try and improve their efficiency, both in terms of knowing their stuff, like, and knowing where to go, i.e., spending time with the coaches and learning, but then also how well they're moving. And I think also like rugby's generally like some of the positions you get put in can be pretty stressful, and you've got to be able to adopt those positions. So I just think, general focus on strength and size, whilst it's important, it's not the end point, really. And there's a lot of other things to consider, and athleticism is the key. So like if I've got an under 20s player that can't jump and land on one leg, like, you think, bloody hell, like, this is a concern, really. Or can't perform a lift with one leg because he doesn't have the balance. Like, those things are concerning, despite the fact he can put 200 kilos on a partial range squat. Like, I'm not too fussed, to be honest. So I completely agree with you.
It is really interesting because I share that philosophy of, like, they're sportsmen first. And one of the things I did when I came into my new role, which was previously very metrics-based and very much squat, bench, chin, power clean, etc., was revamp that back and say, well, actually the biggest gift I can give these guys is more time on their craft. You know,
yeah.
If we can increase their capacity to go from 8 hours of training a week to 12 hours of training a week, then that's more opportunities to get technical input and improve their scrummaging or their lineout throwing, whatever. Yeah. And actually, as you said, that's what's going to make them a better player, not their bench press, you know?
And I do think, like, there's definitely, I'm not saying I'm on either side of the fence, because there's a place for both. And the capacity side of things is important. I just think it's more the mindset around rushing it that is the thing. So, again, with a young rugby player, like, we've got to spend time on general development, because the majority of what they do is specific. They play and train a hell of a lot. I'd question the quality of the experiences they have on the training pitch. So more development opportunities I'd push for instead of competitive opportunities, particularly at a young age. And that's quality development opportunities, because playing in a school game where they win 80-0 is not quality development, but it's still a stress. And of course, we've got to support building the engine. You can't deny that. It's not either or, but yeah, like, it's just the rush. And you know, I it's not hard to get kids strong. So I can make myself look really good and hide behind squat, bench, and chin numbers. And look, we have standards for that, and we have expectations for that. However, if it's stealing from their ability to be fast, to move well, to be able to jump and land and hop and develop rhythm, coordination, etc. If I'm not touching on any of those elements just to focus on the other stuff, then I'm definitely doing my player a disservice. And then, you know, if I'm, and there might be times where you say, look, there's a period in the year where we're going to chase physical development. Well, that doesn't mean that you just hide them in the gym for 4 weeks. Like, they're still maximizing their opportunity to do skill-based work and to practice their craft. It might just look different to high intensity game-based stuff. So you never remove them from their sport. But yeah, there's definitely a tension there, and it's not an either or argument, but yeah, that'd be my thoughts.
Definitely. So you've obviously spent a considerable amount of time working at the youth level across Leicester, Gloucester, in your time at England Rugby. So what are some of the challenges you've faced and experienced when it comes to physical prep at that youth academy level?
Yeah. The main challenge is around the number of stakeholders and the number of environments that the kids operate in. I mean, if you put your you know, your club hat on, you might say, you know what, I want to have full control in order to maximise the, you know, the job I can do from a physical development, or the job we can do. And that was definitely my mindset initially. I think when you actually think about it, and you know, there's a lot of evidence out there, and you speak to a lot of experienced coaches, like, breadth of experience for young kids is important. Club or academy is not more important than school environment. You know, they've got to get their education. So I think, like, the number of environments and number of stakeholders is the most challenging part, but it's important that they have that balance in their life, because not many kids make it. So I think there's a massive responsibility on us as the stakeholders to work around the individual and develop a program that's suitable. And that means that everybody compromises to get what's best for the kid. So whether that is there's an academic stress period coming up, whether it means there's something tough going on at home and we need to know about it, whether that means actually there's an opportunity to do more from a rugby or physical development perspective with the academy. The biggest challenge is when that communication doesn't happen. And then what you've got is young players being pulled from pillar to post, don't have clarity on the direction they're heading in, feel like they're being overworked. Something has to give, whether they get ill or injured, or whether they drop off on their schoolwork, or whether they get demotivated from the sport, because that happens. They're the biggest challenges, and that's the biggest roadblock. And a lot of the work we've been pushing centrally is around this long-term planning piece. So what does success look like for a young professional, well, aspiring professional player at the end of the year? What are their key work-ons from a lifestyle perspective, an athletic development perspective, from a rugby perspective? Like, what are the routes to get in there? What could a year look like? Who are the key players? How do we get them in a room and talk? Now, people get hung up on the document that gets produced at the end of it that we know changes, like plans, plan in pencil, plans change as soon as you get going with it. But it's the planning process and the communication process. So as staff, we have a responsibility to build relationships with all stakeholders that we might encounter. So it's a chaotic world for a young kid, and we're there just trying to hold their hand and support them and navigate them through the chaos. Parents have got to be involved. They have to be involved, because no one knows them better. No one really knows what their aspirations are. No one knows what they're like behind closed doors better than their parents. So they are the challenges. So before we haven't spoken about specifics on S&C, or it's just trying to align stakeholders and communicate. And with that, you need to be really transparent with your what you want in your specific area. Clarity of expectations, goals. Players got to understand why and what they're aiming for. They'd be the biggest. I think another challenge. And it's always the case. Well, it's always the case, right? This whole winning versus developing piece. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Being competitive and striving to win is important, and it's part of the development process. But I think at my level, the under 20s level, is actually the hardest piece, because we operate in competitions, Six Nations and under 20s World Championship, at an age where players are starting to, they're having to. Learn to win as such, or we call it tactically adapting to win. However, with changing coaches, we've had quite a lot of change in our coaching staff a lot, comes different expectations. So whereas I come at it from a bottom-up perspective probably a bit more, because a lot of my experiences have been with academy athletes, I'm still thinking I've got a responsibility, and the programs that we put together, a responsibility of developing each individual. Some coaches I've worked with, and quite rightly, it's a good tension, come at it from premiership roles, etc., saying, well, this is about them, this period is about them trying to maximize their performance and win, and they're the tensions, and I think that's important. And if you didn't have either side of the coin, I think you'd go too far one way or the other. So that's a natural tension. I think managing expectations of significant others is important. So in our world, that's senior coaches and staff. They would be comparing an 18-year-old to your British Lion that's in the squad, and not what your British Lion looked like when he was an 18-year-old. So again, you're constantly, that my thoughts on that would be constantly trying to tell the story of the player, as opposed to, so when they come in for pre-season on day one and they're slightly unfit, it's not a snapshot assessment. So you're constantly trying to tell the story, paint the picture, feed forward information, be proactive, monthly meetings with the DOR in your head of performance around your next best crop. So they've got some understanding. But yeah, they're the sort of typical challenges, really, that you tend to see, I would say.
Yeah, it's kind of a classic one, that bit around stakeholders and everyone wanting their lump of flesh. That's certainly something I've experienced. And as you said, if the communication isn't there, suddenly you're chatting to that athlete in the gym and realising actually they've already played X amount of rugby the night before for school, and they've done double PE and all this kind of stuff. And you're having this conversation, the warm-up, and having to adjust everything you've done, and it is something that happens all the time. So how have you managed to navigate that challenge in terms of getting stakeholders around a table or getting them communicating?
Well, first and foremost, I've got it wrong a lot. So I've learned from, so like when I was at Gloucester, for example, at St Peter's School, we had James Baker, who's an excellent S&C coach, works at Aspire now. At Cheltenham College, you have Henry Davies, who works at the EIS. And now I've walked into an environment, 4 years of Leicester under my belt, just done a little bit with the senior squad throughout a World Cup and Six Nations. And I was like, no, I want control of this. So it's a small patch. They can come in. They can operate my program. And then on reflection, I look back and I'm thinking, I was just, how naive is that? Because I made it a bit more about me. And it took me a few months to realise. And, you know, I've got really good relationships with those guys now because we spent time building those relationships. But I think initially that wasn't my mindset. So big learning for me in that perspective. So first and foremost, you navigate it by building relationships with the stakeholders. So even now, my current role is 20% S&C and 80% relationships and understanding with coaches of all the clubs, of the players, and really trying to understand their perspective. Building trust, because as soon as you've got trust, if something goes wrong in your environment, those guys trust that that they can rely on you, that you've done the right thing. Whereas if that trust isn't there, it becomes bloody England or bloody so-and-so club. So I think that is absolutely vital. And then the other thing that we've done is, you know, I try and make it so that our environment has complete transparency and clarity. So I'll talk about my environment now, but this relates to previous experiences as well and how I'd go about it. But, you know, I can only operate one kind of training model and it's got to suit being able to get an under-20s side or an under-18s side to be able to perform in a fixture at the end of the week. That's going to look different to the 14 other club schedules, for example. We're going to do different amounts of training load. We're going to operate different types of activities. We're going to run a slightly different gym-based model. And we know that a significant risk factor for an injury is probably change. A big emphasis from us is, you know, having really good planning from our end so that we can communicate those expectations, what it's going to look like 4-6 weeks beforehand. And we pride ourselves on 4 to 6 weeks before any camp or competitive period, everyone has all the information they need. We have as much information on every player as possible so that we can make informed decisions on the fly when they come into the environment. And then also you have clarity on what we would expect from a young international player. So that's where some of the assessment standards do come in useful, because, you know, we can goal set collectively and collaboratively between club and country with player involved, such that when they come in and out of each environment, the player knows actually that both environments are facilitative towards their long-term goal, as opposed to club want this, England want this, and there's a dichotomy and the player's caught in the middle. So I think complete transparency, clarity, relationships, you know, players come first. And then accepting that everyone's going to have to compromise. So understanding, you know, what are your real big rocks in this negotiation that you think is really important, and really taking the time to understand another stakeholder's perspective of it as well. And the most important stakeholder is the player, but all the other stakeholders as well. And then come to some kind of compromise, because there's always a better solution than the one that you go into the room with and the one that they come into the room with. There's always a better solution. That would be essentially my strategy around it.
So in terms of some of those key athletic skills or key abilities that you've seen, I guess, you know, both anecdotally and from the kind of research and metrics, what is it that, you know, a young aspiring rugby player needs to be successful in physically to progress into international and professional rugby?
Can you hear that in the background? Sorry.
Yeah, what is that?
I've got building work going on next door. hopefully you can hear me. It's been a nightmare throughout lockdown. They've been bashing away. Literally like a full, like grand designs of the house next door. It's been a nightmare. Anyway, I think from a rugby perspective, let's just appreciate that it's it's probably one of the most challenging sports in there's no definitive, like, this is the way to do things, because, you know, the small guys can run around the big guys can run around the small guys. Even within a positional group, there's many different types of back rower, many different types of center. So that's the beauty. That's where the art of coaching comes in. And I think first and foremost, the first focus is what is it that has defined that individual as talented? Like, what makes him get, like, what sparks your interest in him? Because whatever that is, that has to be what you push throughout his whole career. And even if that doesn't look like what the senior game looks like now. So no one would have thought that you'd see props like Ellis Genge and Carl Sinclair 10, 15 years ago. And you might have tried to push them towards staying as back rowers back in it. Like, so always push their one or two key strengths that are gonna excite you. So that's the most important thing. But yeah, generally from our perspective, we would identify sort of three tiers. So first thing is, like, first and foremost for a rugby player, they've got to be available. So in order to get better at the sport, they've got to practice their sport. So they've got to be available. So robustness side of things, like, you've got to make sure that these guys are resilient. So, you know, can players adopt the postures and positions demanded of them on the field? And some of them are pretty extreme ranges. So that's where, you know, this how well approach is so important, because do they have the competency and the ability to be efficient in those movements, such that it's not going to place undue stress on them and therefore potentially cause further issues? So can they adopt the postures and positions? We know that they've got to have, although, like we've discussed the role of strength, but they've got our base levels of strength and global and also local tissue strength and endurance, just so that, you know, they can tolerate the kind of forces that they're going to be exposed to. They've got to have a base level of capacity, aerobic capacity, so they can recover between bouts, sessions, weeks, and actually back-to-back training. And I think, you know, they've got to be able to tolerate the highest demand that they're going to face. So lads have got to sprint, and I think from a robustness perspective, if you're ticking off those boxes, you're doing a fairly good job. And then from there, and I think that's the same for all positions. So the next thing is, like, what physical qualities get the players to the table. So, you know, for a prop, that would be, this is where you start to get a little bit more specific as you go through, but, you know, for a prop, they've got to have a certain level of lean mass and body mass. They've got to have a certain level of absolute strength. They've got to be able to adopt a position such that they can be effective in a scrum. If you don't have that, then it's all great. It's great that they're available, but they're not getting opportunity to train and play and develop. So the next is, they're available to train, but then how do we give them the opportunity, i.e. the coach has confidence putting them in there. For a second row, they've got to be able to jump and land proficiently. They've got to have a certain level of absolute strength so they can push. For a scrum half, if they don't have the aerobic capacity to get to a breakdown repeatedly and make good decisions, then that's going to massively impact. So they're the things that just get you to the table. So robustness qualities get you to the table. I need to come up with a better name for that. And then finally, like, we sort of look for, like, look, what's what I spoke about initially, but international qualities, we called it, but all your points of difference. So this is individual specific, like, what is it? Like I said, what makes you select them? Hammer that home, but also, you know, an international quality for a prop could be, right, we know they've got the body mass, they've got the strength, they've got the ability to get in a good scrum position. However, this guy, we're going to maximise his involvement, so fitness is going to be an absolute priority, and we're going to try and make him as dynamic as possible. And he's got that. So, you know, his acceleration ability, his power, is world class. Like they're the sort of tiers, really. So I think you identify on the points of difference and the what I've termed international qualities, and that because that's what makes them stand out. And then you're always trying to supplement with making sure guys have got the requisite physical abilities to be robust and to get selected to allow them to be able to express the stuff that makes them special. So they would be my key things. And I think it does start to get a little bit more position specific at that stage.
So what about in terms of, you know, off the pitch and outside the gym, what are the other kind of traits or skills that you see, you know, I mean, we all have, you know, examples of great athletes who should have made it, but their personal organization let them down or their, you know, goal setting or whatever it was. So is there any other skills that maybe, I guess, players or coaches might undervalue and overemphasize, okay, their technical skill or their physical ability, but actually they're being let down by this other area?
Whilst that last question, like hammering home the physical side of things, let's just remember that in general, the physical qualities are what allow you to compete and be competitive. And it's how good you are at your sport and a lot of the mental qualities that determine whether you're actually going to go on and be really good. And I think that's been proven by evidence. So it's like development of those psychological skills. Has got to permeate throughout your development program, right throughout, you know, from the minute they enter a pathway or enter your environment, you're working on that side of it. So I think we talk a lot around like players that are self-organizing, self-reliant. I think that is really important because ultimately it's their journey. And they spend a lot more time away from the environment than they do in the environment. And fundamentally, it's them that take to the pitch. So always trying to empower them to make decisions and fail and learn from that. I've been guilty and still am at times of controlling too much. I think it's natural, particularly for our S&C and medical staff, that we do a bit too much because we worry about risk of an injury and quite rightly so. I think we've got to be willing to give players a bit of rope. I think this period with COVID has shown that actually, you know, I've been so impressed with, you know, the way players have cracked on with their own stuff and applied themselves. And actually, if you put trust and you educate and give them understanding and you give them clarity on what it is they're working on, why they're working on it, I think they can surprise you. So, you know, as I think sometimes we're reluctant. So we talk about self-organized, self-reliant. I think that guys have got to be tough and competitive. And I think that is a real. I think that can look different to different people as well. And I definitely think players and people can show those qualities in one environment but not another. So I do think it's domain specific. So you always, you know, your environment is always trying to breed this element of competitiveness, because when it comes down to it, that's what you need. You need people that are going to put their hand up and dig in when it really matters. You know, players that are. And I just think as well, players that have got a sense of realism, you know, about where they're at, so, you know, their competence on certain things, that can reflect on bad experiences and learn. You know, we're always trying to foster an environment where we're ensuring that players are learning. So players have got to have that sort of mindset around getting better. There would be my sort of big three, really. So the self-reliant piece, the competitive piece, and then the realistic performance. I know, like the PCDE framework would say realistic performance evaluation, but just generally like knowing where they are and how they're going to get better. I think maybe the key things, really.
So what are some of the lessons that you've learned so far in your time working in rugby around athletic, around, you know, developing young athletes?
First lesson is that professional sport isn't glamorous, particularly if you work in youth sport as well. So hours are long, a lot of late nights, a lot of early mornings. It's tough. But so you've got to have a real passion for it. So people that, yeah, I think you quickly find out the guys that do and don't love it. So secondly, you've got to love coffee. I think we spoke about that, but yeah, I don't think I know anyone in rugby that doesn't have a caffeine addiction. I don't think this is necessarily just specific to rugby, but in my early years, and you're still always trying to, you know, develop your knowledge and your model of how you do things. But I was so worried about what I taught or what I coached. But everyone's so different. So I think as you become more experienced, you appreciate this a lot more and your methods become a lot more adaptable, but you become a lot more principle based in your thinking. So I think just an appreciation that everyone's so different. There isn't one way. As long as we are moving certain qualities forward and we're seeing progress, then that's the key at the end of the day. And so I don't think that's necessarily just specific to rugby. So egos go in pockets, or we leave egos at the door, sorry. And I think methods, people can just get hung up on methods and what you teach, as opposed to adapting to individuals and environments and to coaches and stakeholders that you might want to work with. So that would be my biggest lesson. Like I said earlier, there's always a better way that works for most people, that works for all of us. So let's try and work together and collaborate to find that. I think that's important. I think the rugby environment in itself is unique. And I think early on, and look, we're professionals and we hold ourselves, you know, to a particular high standard when we coach. And I think that's important. But also, I'd also say, like, enjoy the environment. Like, it's great fun. Let your guard down a little bit. Let players and coaches see who you really are underneath your work. Because I think that's when you really start to build the relationships and the trust and the understanding, like when you actually start to get to know people. Whereas I think I've always been, and my big thing was always, you know, I'm guarded. I've got my work life and my personal life. I don't want any crossover. Whereas I've been a lot more comfortable in recent years, sort of letting my guard down in that respect. And yeah, look, I just think a lot of the, we've touched upon it previously, but typically what endures and what makes the best people genuinely the best people are just their approach to, you know, like we said there, like how they learn and constantly try and get better, how they're competitive. And that's practitioners, that's players. So constantly in this mindset of you've never quite cracked it, there's always something you can learn. You can learn something from anyone, whether they're A1 on an internship or whether they're 40 years into career, there's something that you can learn from them. And we owe it to the players we coach to constantly keep striving to make ourselves better through learning. And that means failing at times. But yeah, they'd be the big things really. So not necessarily hugely specific to rugby, but yeah, I think transferable across a lot of domains really.
Yeah, definitely. So having coached, I guess, you know, at the earlier end and as well as, you know, involvement, I guess, at the top end of things, are there any skills that stand out that you think coaches working at the youth end of things need to be developing rather than those who are working maybe at the older end? Or is it just the way, the context that's applied? What are your thoughts on that?
I think, Jem, what you tend to get at the senior end is a lot more specialists in their craft. It's resourced better. There's a bit more staff. I think when you work in a youth athlete setting, you're working, you know, you're performing multiple roles. So talk about this generalist sort of versus specialist approach, right? And I think that's something that I do love as well. Like, I think I got great breadth to the role, and I think that's the thing around working with young athletes, that you've got to really work to make sure you've got good competence in a number of areas, but you might not be an expert in any of them. So I think that's one of the things from a coaching perspective. I think with youth athletes, you've got to have the mindset that what you see is not what you get. So at any one time, like, let's avoid any snapshot judgments. Let's avoid writing people off and based on what their ability is telling us here and now. But let's, like I say, work on those qualities that are enduring and will ensure that players improve. Now, some of them have a ceiling. Some of them have great potential that, you know, they can go on to dizzy heights, but you're always trying to develop the qualities that would last. And that's stuff we've touched upon previously. Whereas, you know, with senior guys, it is a bit more what you see is what you get. And you can sort of tweak it a little bit here and there. But, you know, you're with a youth athlete, like, you're constantly trying to shape their perception of, like, you're always there. Whenever they experience a situation, you're there to appraise it and support them appraising it for them. So if they lose a game, how you interact with them following that is going to massively dictate their mindset around it. So if it's, you know, questions around, you know, what are your learnings? How did you apply effort? How do you think we collaborated as a group? What are your reflections on how you applied yourself in the week prior to the game? Like, those kind of questions versus, you know, more, you know, you hear about this, like, growth versus fix sort of thing. I think you've got a real role to play there, as I think with senior athletes are a bit more fixed and you know, can't necessarily change that worldview as much. I think with regard, alongside that, like, as coaches, you've got to model the behaviours you expect from your players. So you are a role model, and you can't get away from that. So you can't expect one thing of them and not at least demonstrate that in your own practice. And at the same time, I think this is not necessarily young athletes versus senior. I think it's probably a bit more applicable to youth athletes just because of the roller coaster they're going on. But you've got to be consistent and dependable for them. So you are their rock. Like, when it's going really well, stay grounded. When it's going poorly, stay optimistic. I think those things are really, really important. I just think with youth athletes, like a coaching session for a group of youth athletes is a complex social interaction, and no kid is experiencing it the same, because you got some kids that are really confident and have got a massive ego and a head boy at their school and have always done really well, and then you got some kids that are physically undeveloped and maybe while wondering, why am I even in this room? But the coach sees some talent in. Like, there's heaps of stuff going on there. So it's not necessarily what you teach, but what they learn. It's not necessarily what you say, but what they hear and how they experience it. So again, getting to know the players. And you probably try with young athletes, and you probably work harder on getting to know their background, their family situation, probably a bit more. Just because you're constantly trying to work out what is the right stimulus or challenge that's going to develop them appropriately. And for some guys, that's an arm around the shoulder. Some guys, that's, you know, a bit more carrot than stick. Some guys, it's more stick than carrot. So I think they're the sort of things that I think would be the key differentials, to be honest, from my perspective.
So if people were kind of interested in thinking or widening their scope in terms of things they're looking at, are there any kind of resources that you might signpost people to that you found useful?
I think the first resource is just going and coaching, regardless of whatever level. So get your hands dirty, whether it's S&C, whether it's rugby or football or netball, whatever, just go and coach. And that's your biggest learning. And then put yourself on, like, offer your services, put yourself on the doorstep of good people and just stay consistent and be there, because I think this is not necessarily advice to coaches coaching you, but this is advice to young coaches just trying to get an opportunity. Like, people, like, much prefer the devil they know to the devil they don't, and the amount of appointments and stuff that happen in professional sport generally come from, you know, the guys that have interned on a Tuesday or Monday night for 6 months and then opportunities come available. So I just think go and coach and be consistent and learn some lessons in that environment, I think would be the first thing. Like, resources wise, I think there's so much out there. So look, some key influences for me, like a lot of my work, particularly for young athletes, is influenced from, I know you had him on the podcast, but like Kelvin Giles, like people like that massively underpin a lot of the programs I would put together. I would visit school environments and see how they do it, because like those ones which with good S&C coaches have very good curriculums, and I think there's a lot to be learned, and you see how they would organise sessions, how they would, you know, put principles of long-term development together, progressive curriculums, etc. So I think, yeah, a lot of that stuff. I think I would always encourage people to working with youth athletes to explore just general like talent development research. So you got models of participation, like COTE, long-term athlete development model. Like, all of them have got flaws, but it gives you, like, I think that kind of stuff is really important. The work that has come out of UCLan in terms of psychological characteristics, etc. I think that's all really valuable work. Because I think where I sort of probably my first couple of years, I went really specific with the kind of reading I would do, and I was reading hours and hours on like biochemistry, and whilst it's important to know that stuff, I would encourage people working with young athletes, linking to the last point, to have breadth, to be general. So I would sort of say just diversify your experiences a little bit as well. And then I would just say, go and knock on the door of people that have got a track record of doing things well. Not necessarily the guys that are, you know, winning the league every year because they've got loads of resource, but like who's consistently done well, whether in terms of developing young players, and just go and try and pick people's brains and find out what it is they're doing, because they're the ones, particularly if there's minimal resource, because they're the ones that are doing good stuff, and learn from the guys like that learn from those people really that have just got a good track record. Yeah, they'll be the sort of things. And look, there's a lot of good people on Twitter, like Kelvin Giles, like I mentioned, Jeremy Frisch, guys that work in schools, like I work a lot with a guy called Graham Williams at Millfield, brilliant, but there's a lot of other good school practitioners, like, or world-class school practitioners knocking around, James Baker being another one that I've mentioned before. Like, there's some really, really, really good people. So yeah, that would be what I'd sort of, where I'd sort of suggest, really, more experiential and tapping into coaching knowledge, and then just being general with your reading and stuff.
Brilliant. So for those people who are interested in learning a bit more about you, where can we signpost them in terms of social media or websites or anything like that?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is @PSRVE. Bit of a strange one, because initially, like I said, in terms of being guarded, like when I was younger, I didn't necessarily want to put myself out there. So I created a private Twitter account just to follow people. PSRVE was like my university username. And then, you know, recently took the plunge about a year ago to take it off private, but a lot of that, like, I use it a lot for, you know, seeing what's going on. I retweet stuff that I want to read, not necessarily everything that, mm-hmm. It's not necessarily stuff I've read or I've seen that I've liked, but I am becoming a lot more active on there and engaging in a bit more conversation. So yeah, I'd say people can get me on there. And then also like my email, robineager@rfu.com, like always open to discussions, to chat to coaches, always open-minded from wherever, inside of rugby, outside of rugby. Yeah, really keen to collaborate and engage. So they'll be the two main places really.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Robin. It's been an absolute pleasure and really useful, you know, personally for me to kind of have a chat. And I know it will be useful for those listening. So thanks again for your time.
Thanks very much for your time, mate. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, it's been a great experience. So yeah, thanks for your time.